We shall all take our place, but who's really in charge? I remember I heard once about an employer who was interviewing candidates. This guy came in with this sort of disheveled hair, and the employer said, "For this job, we need someone who's really responsible." And the guy said, "I'm your person. I'm really responsible." And he goes, how do you know that? And he said, "They were always telling me this in my previous job. Whenever anything would go wrong, they would say, 'You are responsible.'" We're all responsible. We all have responsibility. We all have a duty to help prevent the spread of disease. We are all responsible for washing our hands and covering our mouth when we cough and staying home when we're sick. But who is responsible for taking care of those who are at home when they're sick? Who is responsible for caring for those who are vulnerable, most vulnerable, those on the streets who have little protection? Who is responsible for caring for the vulnerable and the needy? Who is responsible for making sure the doctors have enough hand sanitizer when everyone else is making a run for their own on the supplies in the country? Who is responsible? We're all responsible, but in what way and how? Instead of placing one person in position of responsibility, we tend to, as Unitarian Universalists, call upon the use of the democratic process. In this fellowship, we are all responsible for upholding our covenant. No one enforces it, no one demands it, no one holds anyone in judgment of whether we hold the covenant or not. We must each choose, decide how we're going to live it out and what it means. Each of us must decide how we're going to shape the community, how we will live with one another, how we will live our lives. We are all responsible. But there's an old saying, if everybody's responsible, then it's probably true that nobody is. Who's in charge? Who makes the decisions? Because we value freedom here, we affirm the democratic process. But sometimes we need structure. Not just vague process and occasional times for votes. We need all sorts of processes where we can share our wisdom, where we can make choices, where we can give people accountability to carry things forward and get things done. Though sometimes in religious communities, it's very common in American organizations and sometimes in very special in religious communities where there's this sort of open-endedness and this freedom where we establish what I call the whatever norms. Whatever norms are those where, and I have this whenever I come into a congregation, I'll say, you know, how do we get something done? And they go, well, I'll say, you know, how do we do this? And people won't know. I'll say, what is it that we do? What is it that we do here in this fellowship? And people will say, well, whatever we want. And I'll say, who is it that's going to do that? And they go, well, whoever really wants to. And I said, well, so how are they going to do it? And people will say, well, however they want to do it. And I go, and when are they going to do it? And they go, whenever they can. And then I say, and if they fail to do what we needed them to do, they go, whatever. On the other hand, sometimes we put people in charge. And you've always heard that there's always this 20% of the, you know, if you really need something to get done, ask someone who's way too busy, because they're the people who know how to get things done. Right? There's often a 20% in a congregation who just takes charge because no one else is really taking charge and they're willing to have that responsibility. But then this burden gets put on their shoulders. I've often felt that congregations, or well, not often, but there's these occasions where I have these moments where I think the reason that a congregation calls a minister is so that they have someone to blame when things go wrong. We want to hold somebody accountable. We need to think about the ways in which we share responsibility, the ways in which our authority and our power and our decision-making are actually spread through the process, through structure, instead of concentrating on certain individuals. I remember in St. Louis, Earl and I have both served this wonderful congregation in St. Louis. You come in the front door, they've taken an old building and merged it with new buildings, and there's this entryway. You come in the entryway, there's stairs going up and hallways going off to different directions and maybe a few signs that sort of indicate where you're supposed to go. And there was a table in there. It's kind of under the, in the stairwell there. And when I first got there, it was an odd table. It always had a vase on it that never had anything in it. There was a lamp that was sometimes on and sometimes off. There was an odd collection of items on that table. I was not sure why that table was there or what, and so I would start asking, like, who's responsible for this table? Who put those things there? And it was all those whatever norms. And it turns out that there had been a woman, one woman, who had been the head of the greeters, and she had, her chair was still there. She would sit in that chair. She would organize. She would welcome people. She organized it. But when she died, it was not an official position, so no one else took official responsibility. There were always those people who would see it was messy, or someone had left something on the table, and they would rearrange it. But no one was responsible. And the whole aesthetics of coming into the building was kind of one of a strange anteroom. It had no real purpose, and it had no... So I asked, who's going to take responsibility? And finally, we found that the people who were in charge of membership and greeting, the greeters people, said, we'll do it. And they rearranged it. They bought a new lamp. They decided what was going to be on the table, what would not be. They moved the table out a little bit. It became a center, a focal point, a directing, so people could be told which way to go instead of having to look around and find those strange little signs that told them where to go. By giving someone responsibility and accountability for making that a beautiful space, it was returned to its original, the vision of being a place of welcome. When human groups grow, you know, when they're small and you just have whatever norms, it's whoever wants to step up. Generally, small churches, less than 150, are really good at just coordinating. People are at each other's houses and they see each other and they talk about it, they coordinate. But you start getting beyond 150, 200 members, like this congregation, 300 members, you need to start figuring out ways of communicating, structuring communication, of coordinating so that everyone can still be responsible and yet there's some focus and channel for the desires. And as human communities grew, we found throughout all human history there has been this moment where we gave someone ultimate authority. In China, it was called the mandate of heaven. In Europe, it was called the divine right of kings. From Peru to the Ashanti people, from the Inca people in Peru to the Ashanti people in Eastern Africa, there was always someone who was given total control and power. Kings and queens and rulers, they were called in Europe. There was one key moment in European history. The British king, Richard IV, this is 1193, was accused by the Holy Roman Emperor of doing some wrong things in wars and political machinations. And they called him to a council. And his response began, I am born in a rank which recognizes no superior but God, to whom alone I am responsible for my actions. I've actually heard Unitarian Universalists say something similar to this. I'm responsible for my actions and no one else can judge me. Right? But then the king said, King Richard IV said, but you, the Holy Roman Emperor, are so pure and honorable that I voluntarily and cheerfully render an account of my actions to the whole world. So there's this tension between responsibility and accountability. Can you really be held accountable for what happens, what you're in charge of? Right now, we all are responsible for living well on this good earth, for living sustainably. But who is really carrying the responsibility to move the whole world towards climate balance, protecting all that is being lost, grieving all that will be lost? We like the idea sometimes of a strong-armed person who will take charge, but we know, first of all, that that person cannot see everything and will not always make good decisions. And we know also that when you give that kind of divine absolute right to one person, they will misuse it. They will use it in ways that harm and hurt. The king could just simply say, kill this person, and that person was dead. No questions, no doubt. You may know that the chalice, the symbol of the flaming chalice, came into Unitarian Universalism during World War II. We needed a symbol to put on our, we were helping people escape the Nazi regime, helping people get out of Nazi Germany, and we needed a symbol that would mark our pathways, would mark our people, would mark our supplies, food supplies and things like that. And there was an artist that we got out of Czechoslovakia named Hans Deutsch. And Hans had this image of the cup of service and sacrifice burning with that flame of helpfulness. And he specifically referred to Roman rituals in which there was a bowl with a stem that had flame in it. But he was a Czech. So I know for a fact that he had in his mind also Jan Hus. Jan Hus, back at the end of the Middle Ages, had been a Christian leader who had noticed the corruption of power in the Christian church and the political systems that it supported and that supported it. There was corruption, there was money being passed back and forth between temporal rulers and religious rulers. And the priests had way too much political power. And what had happened in the ritual, they had this communion, right? Christian community, which is the moment where everyone is supposed to be sharing in the spiritual power of their religion, of their understanding of the great truth of love and justice in the world. But it had devolved into such a way so that only the priests could touch the cup. It actually had started, this practice had started because people were afraid of spilling. All the average people were afraid of spilling the sacred wine and touching the cup, this valuable cup. So it had been put into the hands of the priests. But now the priests just sipped the wine themselves, and Jan could see this as a symbol of all the corruption that was going on, all the misuse of power in the Christian church. And so he demanded that everyone be able to not only to touch the cup, but to sip from the cup. They didn't have things like Center for Disease Control and Understanding of Germs back then. It was a powerful symbol. And also the reading of the scriptures. Before, only the priests could read the scriptures. Only the priests could tell you what it meant. You couldn't even think about it. And now Jan Hus was saying, I'm going to read this to you, and you're going to think about it. He was trying to share the power. And so centuries later, you know, this was 200 years before Martin Luther pounded his thesis about corruption in the Christian church on that door in Wittenberg. Jan Hus, 200 years earlier, and centuries later, through the great arc of Western civilization in particular, democratization, spreading out of power, this vision and this understanding that we all need to share responsibility and we need to create structures that will help us carry that forward. I remember in one congregation I was a part of, there was a family, a young family. They had some boys, they were teenagers. And she got cancer. The wife was a heterosexual couple, so the wife got cancer, cervical cancer. It killed her within a year. And I was there on the day after she died, and I said, you know, we talked about how the congregation would help this family in this time of grief. And then I called back the next day to see how they were doing. I called the husband, he picked up the phone, and I said, how are you doing? And he said, I am exhausted. He said, everybody is coming by. I'm crying way too much. You know, he was just overwhelmed. He was just feeling this. He said, it's so beautiful. All these people, they all feel responsible for helping me, but I can't handle it. He goes, we now have more food than me and my sons and I could eat in 3 weeks. And so immediately called the pastoral care team, and I said, you need to be responsible. You need to be accountable for making sure that we structure the way in which we show our care and our love. They created sign-up sheets so that people would call up and say, what kind of food do you need? How much food do you need? Can I bring it by? You know, they would have only one person who would contact them instead of different people all the time. And so when we celebrated her life, the family was able to be present with their community who loved them and who had nurtured them. But we needed that structure. And we needed someone who was willing to carry and hold that structure that allowed all of us to show our love and care. In this congregation, one of the things I keep talking about as I've come is that we don't really have much structure, or it's amorphous. In most people's minds, there's a board And then there's some committees, and we don't know really what the relationship is between them. There's all kinds of committees. Brunch committee is worship committee. There's no structure to that. And so I'm trying to help your leaders think about how do we structure the democratic power that we have, our shared commitment to living out our covenant. In this world, there are not enough structures. Most people know that we need to do something more about climate change, but we don't know how to channel that desire. We don't have enough structures to channel that power and that need in the world. We need the use of democratic processes, not only to give everyone a voice, but also to find those people who are willing to channel and structure and control and organize the actions of so many. We have seen this long arc, the labor movement and essentially leaderless movements like the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street and the Arab Spring, these events in which people understand that we are all responsible, we all care. But eventually, to turn the myriad passions and desires of these leaderless movements into productive change, someone must be elected. Someone must make choices. That is what we mean when we say we affirm the use of the democratic process in our congregations and in society at large. There's a moment that Jan Hus was reading scriptures, and he found in both in the epistle, 1 Peter, and then in Revelations, this phrase that we are now all kings and all of us priests became the roots of the Reformation and the idea of the priesthood of all believers, that we are all kings and queens. We all carry the power and the responsibility. But we've learned also that we need the structures and the ways that allow us to all be kings and queens, to focus our commitment and to make the fire burn brighter. That is why we have the chalice as part of our symbol, to focus the flame and the single flame representing the light that burns in all of us.